Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site and fm1032.com.au.
13 years ago to the day, the Rwandan genocide came to an end. That's right, 13 years today. And our next guest came to Australia around a decade ago after miraculously surviving through that genocide, which saw the murder of around 800,000 people. It's hard to even imagine, isn't it? 800,000 people. In fact, Bill Clinton, who was obviously the president of the US at the time, said it was possibly the world's worst humanitarian crisis in a generation. Oliver Kumaya says he survived the slaughter by nothing more and nothing less than God's grace. He's now an IT professional in a government department, and he says it's his duty to tell people what happened in Rwanda, and he joins us now. Oliver, welcome to Open House.
Oh, thank you.
It's great to have you here. Let's start with the beginning and with your childhood. What was it like growing up as a child in Rwanda?
Well, I can say that I had a very good childhood. I had Christian-loving parents who instilled in me a sense of responsibility. And I remember that most of it I hated it, but when I look at it right now, I think, wow, it's good. I'm glad that my mom asked me to do this. And my mom, in fact, it came in handy at some point where after they were both dead, that I took over the family responsibility to look after my brothers and sisters who, it was at that point, I think, a lesson in life where you think it's, you know, I'm glad I had my parents and who looked after me very well.
Kind of upbringing you had.
Yes, yes.
Mm. Yeah, so. How old are you now, Olivier? Oliver?
Olivier.
Olivier. That's where I'm getting it wrong. Olivier.
Yeah, Olivier. I've just turned 33.
So yes. You were 20 when the genocide happened. When did things go wrong?
Well, it depends on which way you look at it. For us, for example, for myself, I think we knew things were not right because I was born in a refugee camp for the only single reason that there was something like a mini genocide at the period where in 1973, where they just had to, you know, to kill everyone who was somehow educated. It didn't take, it wasn't to an extent of 1994, but it was effective, so some people went into exile. They allowed some people to go into exile. That's why I was born in a refugee camp. So to that extent, I think people had a period where they were brainwashed and had propaganda into them, and then 1994 just erupted.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, what they will tell them, they just killed the president. If they killed this important man, what do you think they're going to do to you? So. Mm. You know, in 1994, at the start of the year, we knew things were not right because there were certain events that happened that, you know, people were being attacked and certain politicians were being killed. You know, we had grenades thrown at our family home. So
at yours?
Yes.
Your own home? You had grenades thrown at it?
Yes.
What was the cause of that? Why? Simply because you were a Tutsi?
Yes, partially yes, because those who went into exile starting from 1959, they were denied to come back to Rwanda for the only purpose that there was not enough for everyone, so they just kept them out. And in 1990, they decided to come fighting. At that time, the government decided that even if they succeed, they will never find whoever they left back home. Some of them still had relatives back in Rwanda. So the government decided that you're not going, even if you succeed, you're not going to find those you left back home alive.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the whole point of the genocide. You decide to kill one part of the population, and we were targeted because we were Tutsi.
Yeah. If you watch a movie like Hotel Rwanda, you know, you see those awful scenes where you have mobs in four-wheel drives running around, basically being stirred up by somebody on a radio station.
Mm.
Did you hear any of those broadcasts, actually?
Yes.
Now, what was that like?
Well, the radio station was in circulation for 2 years prior to the genocide, and it was constant messages of hatred.
Get rid of the cockroaches.
Yeah, get rid of them. You know, they would just, they had songs and they had propaganda that was just for that particular purpose. And, you know, they will say, well, these people, this person is here, go and find them. And but on some occasions, it was good because we'll know what they are talking about, and we run home, or, you know, we just find a way where to hide.
Right.
But it was very effective because that was the only means of getting across the message to a broad spectrum of listeners. Mm. Even those who, you know, every person had a mini radio, they could hear the radio. So, you know, they will say the president has been killed and this part of the country have finished to do their work. What are you waiting? So, you know, radio was very effective in putting out the message.
Yes, and getting a whole bunch of people basically stirred up to do absolute evil. You must have been living in fear then for years.
Well,
did you just get used to it?
As I you know, get asked that question all the time. How did you manage to survive for that long? We lived in survival mode for 20 odd years. That at a certain period we just reached a stage where it became your normal life. You know, I remember when I was growing up, we had constant, you know, people harassing us every 3 months. You know, we could not buy new things, and, you know, we buy new things after 3 months, it gets stolen, because that's how people operated. Mm. And it turned into a routine. So you go to school, you know, if tonight someone may come, but you have to protect yourself. But you know, it became a routine for us.
Mm. We're talking to Olivier Kameya, and he survived the horrific Rwandan genocide, which, of course, 13 years ago today, finally ended after 100 days. They call it the 100 days of horror, I guess, for Rwanda. Now, let's talk about what you actually experienced when things really did spill over, when things really finally got horrific. You've already alluded to the fact that your parents didn't make it through.
No.
So what happened? You already had some grenades thrown at your house anyway. What happened for you and your family?
Well, the fact that my father was also a politician, when I was growing up, he was a news reader, so he was involved in the news, and he also had an opposition newspaper, so he was quite critical of the government. That there was no chance for him to, you know, to get through. Even for us, we were quite lucky. That's why every time when someone asked me how did you survive, well, despite the fact that you were on the list, I say, I don't know. You have to ask God when you meet him, because I don't know. I have no idea. Mm. So in 1994. When the president was shot, you know, we woke up and, you know, you could sense, you know, there's that eerie sense.
You could sense the evil.
You can sense that, you know, something is not right. But because we have never experienced it before, we thought, you know, they've done it before and it only lasted a day or so. So this is going to be the same case. But this time they were ready. They had lists. They had written lists before. Just a year before, they had statistics of the whole country. So they knew where people were.
Okay. Did they come to your door?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it was around just the night when the president was shot. In the morning when he woke up, we lived on a hill, and on the opposite side there were a camp of a police camp. So we saw people running, but we didn't, you know, we thought they were just going to be there, they won't come down. And then around 11:30, I saw a pickup full of soldiers just running across, And then just about, they stopped at a guy who was a friend of my father. And a few minutes later, we had shot. And I, for one, I was always a dead. When my mother was to tell me that you're going to get killed in, you know, in a way you don't know. So when they left, I went to have a look. And this guy, he managed to get out, and he was hiding in the bushes. So what they were doing, because they wanted to do it effectively, they used the army first to kill people they wanted to kill, and then they left the rest to the normal population. The army will get in, kill whoever they find in the house, and then they will leave. They will leave the militia to do the combing. So once he got out, he had his brother-in-law and his wife and some members of the family. They shot everyone except him. So when I went in there, I found his wife has been shot 3 times in the head. She was still breathing, but he was outside. I was looking for him, and he told me, they are looking for your father. Mm. You know, that's, they came here looking for him because he used to spend his time there. So they must have mistaken that that was his home. Mm-hmm. So in that time, I called the Red Cross. They told me that they were stretched out. They couldn't spare a car to come and take the, you know, that lady. So I left, and I went and told my family, this is what he just told me. They're looking for you.
Mm-hmm. Where were they? Where were your mum and dad?
They were at home.
Yes, okay.
They were at home.
Okay.
So
what happened then?
My mother, we told my mother, you just have to go. So my mother took the rest of the kids. I had three brothers and four sisters. They just went to a Sisters of Charity's convent. Mm-hmm. So they went there, which was about 500 meters from our place. And we thought, because I had my cousin and my two cousins and my father, so let's stay home and go at home just in case. Just as we were saying that, a pickup full of 20 soldiers pulled in front of the gate. Mm. We had no time to think. We jumped over the fence. When we were over the fence, they were just making a cordon around the house, saying, oh, they are still inside because all the curtains were still drawn. You know, it looks like they're all still inside. And then they just threw grenade inside. And then they spend about 20 minutes there shooting inside and throwing grenades.
Wow.
And I only saw the first 2 minutes, and that's just if the other, no one is inside, they may decide to come after us. So we joined the rest at the Sisters of Charity convent. We stayed a night there, but it was shelling. It was you could not sleep because it was.
Had your parents been killed at that stage?
No.
No? Okay, so they're still alive. So
they were still alive.
At what point did they actually?
When we go there, it's there were lots of events between now and then, you know, that period when they got killed. But because we knew my father was on the list number one because of, you know, his stand against the government. And when they usually do that, they say the father and the, you know, the oldest son, because he's going to be the head of the family. So he's always follow. So me and my father decided to go on his own because it was too dangerous to stay with the whole family. Chances are that if they found all of us there, they would have killed the whole family. And which they did, they came looking for us and they could not find him or myself, and they left everyone else there. Just about two weeks in the genocide, they kept coming at the convent just to ask my father to ask my mother where my father was. In that process, they would beat her up to a point where they came to get her. She could not walk. My sister had to help her. Say, well, you have to come, and no one is going to carry you, and we don't want to kill you in the convent. So my sister carried her. That's how she got. They got shot. Mm. In that period, I was hiding myself. So this story I'm telling you, I've been told by my remaining brothers and sisters.
Yes.
So surprisingly, my father was killed just in middle of June, about the 15th of June.
Right.
So, you know.
Okay. How do you get over something like that?
Well, I
guess, having witnessed some of this stuff as well.
I guess different people have draw strength in different ways, and I suppose I found my own way of dealing with it. I don't think I have got over it. I just thought I dealt with it in a different way. That I think probably in some sort, if I did not have brothers and sisters who to look after, I probably have gone nuts. That's my.
You had a greater cause than yourself to actually live for. Hold on for a second. I want to continue the conversation in just a minute. I'm just going to play some spots, and then we'll get back to a little bit more of your story. We're talking to Olivier Kameya. He survived the Rwandan genocide, and it's quite a story, as you can tell already. I'll explore a little bit more of that in just a minute. This is Open House.
We hope you enjoy this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.